have an announcement after the session about her book, which I'm sure will interest all of you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thompson. It's a wonderful honor and pleasure to be here. We had quite a rainstorm, but I think it looks like the sun is coming out. When I tell people that I've written a book called Music at the White House, they usually immediately think of perhaps President Harry Truman seated at the piano with Lauren Bacall perched on the lid and her legs dangling over, or President Richard Nixon accompanying Pearl Bailey at the piano as she sings in one key and he plays in another. But there is a great deal more to the long, colorful saga of music at the White House that I readily learned after almost 11 years of research on the subject. My book is the story of the performers who have entertained at the White House from George Washington right through the Reagans, and the cultural interests of the various first families. But it is also the tale of the American process of music making. How music in a democracy was absorbed, shaped, transformed, and perceived, and how this music is so intimately bound to the lives and spirits of us all. I remember hearing Mrs. Reagan once say, "What but art can bring tears among strangers?" And you know, music is a very powerful art form. It can move anyone, great or humble. Back in the 1880s, President Chester Arthur was moved to tears by the all-black Fisk Jubilee Singers, and Fred Waring's performance of the Battle Hymn of the Republic brought tears to the President and Mrs. Eisenhower. Old-time ballads made Abraham Lincoln misty-eyed. Haydn string quartets deeply moved Jimmy Carter. And time again, music has moved a president and the mind of a weary chief of state. Impulsively, joyously, quietly. And so my book, you might say, is not only about history, not only about the White House, not even only about music. It is about the human spirit. And it proves that the art of music can mold the political process, shape a historical moment, and capture the human spirit in a manner quite like no other. Now this morning I'd like just to take you on a very brief musical tour of the White House. I thought we'd start at the back door, and I'll share with you some of the joys and trials of researching this topic. Then we'll go around through the front door and into the White House itself and take a glimpse at some of the musical activities of the presidents and first ladies going back to the time of George Washington. What I'm usually asked is, how did I happen to come upon such a topic? It was really accidental. I was researching for my doctoral dissertation on a French composer who had come over to the United States and had been entertained by President Woodrow Wilson only one day after the armistice. And I thought, oh, I'd find a lot of material. I'll just call the White House. And of course, the archives are more recent, although they do have many visual, wonderful historical events and visual aids, but not this particular information. There had never been a book published on the history of the White House. So there were no accessible sources, and it did not really take me very long to realize that the White House is indeed our nation's oldest showcase for the performing arts. And it's a stage like no other. So the adventure began. I had a postdoctoral fellowship, and I set out to explore virtually thousands of documents in libraries and archives scattered throughout the nation. First, I thought I wanted to find out what pianos had been in the White House, because I thought that knowing this, it would give me an idea of how musically active a family was. So I spent several months in the National Archives digging through inventories, receipts, and must-see old documents dating back to about 1810. Now, most of these were frail and crumbling, and they had chipped wax seals and were tied with some very faded old red ribbon, and I untied them very carefully. I didn't find the particular receipt I was looking for, but I was convinced I had discovered the original government red tape. Other sources I explored were in the 7 presidential libraries, and of course you know what those are. Hoover, Franklin, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Ford. And when I was finishing my book, I had a wonderful conversation with Mrs. Carter, who was very generous, but their library had not yet been completed. But I do have to say the most exciting part of the research in this project was the human element, because I did interview many prominent concert artists who had performed in the White House staff, First Family Memories, so the tales here, First Family Members and Tales and Memories here could fill another book in itself, so I will stop right there. But I did have the wonderful privilege of presenting a gold-tooled red leather copy of my book to Mrs. Reagan in the White House, and I also fairly recently presented a copy to Barbara Bush, which was wonderfully exciting to me. People have asked, how do you research the White House? Do you go into the White House to do the research? I had been living in Dallas, Texas, and I had been teaching at Southern Methodist University when I was working on the book, so I had to commute back and forth a great deal. People in that part of the country were fascinated with the fact that maybe I went in the White House. Well, I did, but the White House is not your usual archive or library, and my experiences there were not the experiences of most historians. And I have a funny little story to tell about this. The curator's office is very small and cramped, if any of you know this wonderful office. But they had always been very, very gracious and very kind to me. And every time I go in, they would situate me in one of the elegant rooms of the White House on the lowest floor, and I'd be have this gorgeous Tabriz rug under my feet and pictures on the wall and beautiful china. But one time I was looking through the programs of President Nixon, and I realized that I heard a rumbling and rustling down at my feet, and I looked down very startled, and here were two gigantic, huge dogs sniffing inside my briefcase. And of course I jumped a mile. Very distinguished tall guard next to me said, "Oh, pardon me, ma'am, I'm sorry, we're just looking for bombs." So I learned very rapidly that looking for bombs was an all-pervasive White House task. And of course, every musician that comes into the White House has to have his or her instruments and cases checked. Now I'd like to go around to the front door of the White House and enter through those wonderful, graceful main portals of the president's home. And for this short tour, we have to reach far back into history. Now, of course, George Washington, our nation's first music-loving president, didn't live in the White House today. The first White House, as you all know, was in New York City. It no longer exists. It was called the Presidential Palace. But Washington loved to dance, and he adored music, and he loved the theater. I loved going through the programs and the theater bills that related to his time when he was president. But I have to give you the exact titles of these shows, because they're really, they tell a story of their own. One, The Clandestine Marriage. Another one, High Life Below the Stairs. And another, right, another one, The Way to Get Married. And this one I love, Animal Magnetism. I determined that these were really the Broadway quote-unquote hits of the 1790s. Now, our first presidential families had to live in a White House that was barely constructed and in a capital city that had mud and cow paths and wooden huts. John and Abigail Adams, of course, were the first occupants of the White House, and they had to climb up a makeshift stairway to get to the second floor rooms where their first musical program was held. You all know the story about Abigail Adams hanging her laundry in the Great East Room, which is today the showcase for the arts in the White House. John and Abigail Adams brought music to the White House shortly after they became residents. And I think this tells us something about music and its importance to our nation's people as well as leaders. They brought music. They brought the United States Marine Band, which is our oldest performing arts organization. And they played for the Adams' first New Year's Eve reception in 1801. And they performed regularly to the present day, known as the President's Own. And, of course, Jefferson. What can I say? It's like bringing coal to Newcastle. Thomas Jefferson, as you know, was extremely talented and very much a devotee of the arts. We know he played violin very well, and it was here that I examined his wonderful collection of music. And I always tell people about this collection because it's absolutely fabulous. Pleyel, Boccherini, Haydn, Mozart, composers that he loved, and he played when he was a student in Williamsburg. And he played with people who also loved music as he did. He didn't realize, though, that both he and one of his partners, who played viola and violin, named John Tyler, he didn't realize that one day his partner's son would be president of the United States, as he would be. So this was kind of interesting. Like George Washington and John Adams, Jefferson recognized the value of music in the life of the young. He gave both his daughters music and dancing lessons, took them to every concert, opera, and drama that he could while he was minister to France, and he bought each of them a very beautiful Kirkman harpsichord. Now, Dolly Madison, as you know, assisted President Jefferson with his White House entertaining. But when she became First Lady, the White House saw some of the most brilliant social life of its early history. I think Mrs. Madison was the first presidential family member to dance in the White House. And she introduced the waltz to American society. Now, the waltz at this time was called rather derisively the hugging process set to music. We know that dancing first families provide us with really a wonderful study of social dance in America, as well as the way it was accepted or perhaps not accepted. Presidents who liked to waltz, such as Benjamin Harrison and Warren Harding, were criticized just as loudly as William McKinley, whose enjoyment of the goo-goo eyes two-step at the turn of the century raised some eyebrows. But social dance has often been a joyful, gracious White House diversion, as we know from many of our modern administrations. Our eighth president, Martin Van Buren, was a widower and enjoyed the theater, especially the performances of the great prima ballerina Fanny Elsler. But Elsler, with her voluptuous, hip-swaying dance known as the cachucha, complete with Spanish castanets, was taking all of Washington by storm, all of the nation, as a matter of fact. And she was taking all of Washington by storm at the time. And so provocative was this famous Fanny, in fact, that when she came to Washington, it was decided that Congress would meet only on the days she was not dancing. Now, Jefferson, Truman, and Nixon were not the only presidents throughout history who played musical instruments. But I want to make this point. Playing music for pleasure was very different in the 19th century than it is today. Today we have video, TV, we have all kinds of mass communication to get music into our ears and our homes. But that was not true of the 19th century. Without radio recordings and so forth, people had to actually make music themselves if they wanted to hear it at all. Now, the study of music was considered an important element of education and respectability. And without exception, presidential family members either sang or played instruments, such as the harp, the flute, the violin, piano, and guitar. In the 19th century, the piano was considered a ladies' instrument. And over half of our 19th century first ladies played the piano. This is what I thought was fascinating. And many of them played with a great deal of efficiency. The men, on the other hand, seemed to aspire to the more, quote unquote, complex instruments. What were those? Well, the flute, played by John Quincy Adams, or the violin, played by Jefferson, John Tyler, and Woodrow Wilson. Tyler, as a matter of fact, even had a family orchestra, but I don't think that would have been too difficult because he had 15 children, you know. And he and his wife even formed a little blackface minstrel band that was a style of music all the rage in the 1840s. And since this is one of the predecessors of jazz, you might say we can say that John Tyler and his family had the first presidential jazz band in history. John Tyler, it appears, was the first president to be entertained by a guest performer. Now, you know, this is very, very common today after state dinners. Great opera singers, great performers, entertainers of all kinds come in and entertain. But this performer under John Tyler, his name was Anthony Philip Heinrich, America's Beethoven, as he was called. And he might have been better known and better appreciated in those if he had not written such complicated music. Now, he was invited to come to the White House and play for President Tyler. Right in the middle of a very long, involved, complicated performance, the pianist was very vigorously all worked up with his music and didn't even see the president, who came over, and he yawned and tapped the frenzied pianist on the shoulder and said, "Pardon me, sir, but couldn't you just play a good old-fashioned Virginia reel?" And, of course, Professor Heinrich didn't know any, and he jumped up and he grabbed his music and he took a friend of his out of the White House, and on the street he said, "Oh, mein Gott in Himmel, the people that made John Tyler ought to be hung. He knows no more about music than an oyster." But of course, President Tyler did know a great deal more about music than, say, Ulysses S. Grant. You know that old one about President Grant? It's true. He once said, "I know only two tunes. One is Yankee Doodle, and the other isn't." One style of music that began to capture the American spirit during the middle of the century was grand opera. Few presidents in history have loved opera as much as Abraham Lincoln. Now, I thought it was interesting that it was Abraham Lincoln who actually began the practice of inviting opera singers to the White House. He did for the very first time. He was actually a very unmusical president. By that I mean he could not play an instrument, he could not read music, he could not sing. But his love for music was a real passion. And he loved opera, which at that time was a very close, it was a very intimate art. It was theater that meant, it was almost even political in some cases, because sometimes the entertainers or the singers would insert political or patriotic tunes in the operas. But at any rate, Verdi, Gounod, Meyerbeer, Rossini, Donizetti, all of these operas the president heard. He went to anything he could hear. And when he was criticized for attending the opera so much during the turbulent years of the Civil War, he said simply, "I must have a change or I will die." And I don't know, that rings in my ears so much, because I think how many of us turn to music just momentarily as a form of therapy, and we know it can work wonders. Other opera-loving presidents during this period were Rutherford B. Hayes and Chester Arthur, who succeeded him. Rutherford and Lucy Hayes, in my estimation, were the John F. Kennedys of the 19th century. You know, we don't hear very much about President Hayes. But they invited to the White House over 50 famous opera singers, violinists, pianists, choirs, and even a harpist who had played for Queen Victoria. They also invited a complete opera company to sing in the White House. But Hayes was a very religious man, and he asked if they would please just skip the opera a little bit and sing some good hymns instead, which they did. But I think the loveliest program during this administration was one put on by a coloratura soprano, black lady named Marie Salaika. She seems to be very forgotten, quite forgotten today, because I found very little information about her except that she was called the quote-unquote queen of staccato. And I thought her career was a fascinating one, because America during those post-Civil War years of Reconstruction was really barely ready to accept the black performer outside the confines, which were rather degrading, of the minstrel show. So Marie Salaika had gone to Europe to pursue her career, and she had even sung before crowned heads of state. We will never know what her voice sounded like, but it must have been magnificent. Now then we come to Grover Cleveland, who was the only president in history to serve two non-consecutive terms in office. He was also the only president to be married in the White House, and he married the beautiful, very charming Frances Folsom, who was 21 and he was 49. And how the tongues did wag in those days. Grand Opera was not Grover Cleveland's cup of tea, but he did like the new Gilbert and Sullivan operettas that were all the go in America, so much so that he asked the leader of the Marine Band, John Philip Sousa, to play some of the Mikado at his wedding reception, which was held in the White House. And I thought, let's see, what would he have played? And I made a guess, and I was right, because I found the music and found the documentation. Can you guess what it might have been from the Mikado? Oh, he's going to marry Yum Yum. Now, President Theodore Roosevelt and his wife Edith were especially cognizant of the important role that music played in the life of the nation. I was so thrilled when I finally got to Theodore Roosevelt, because here in the National Archives are these wonderful sets of programs and memos, and you could follow the social life of the Roosevelts very nicely, which tells us something about the way we were moving as a nation in the arts. The arts were becoming much more important. The White House was becoming a centerpiece for the arts. With the administration of Theodore Roosevelt, 1901 to 1909, we find this focal point for the arts, but also what helped the arts of the White House was the donation of the first state concert grand piano to the White House by Steinway & Sons. And this was in 1903. This piano is in the Smithsonian today, all covered with gold leaf. So, what happens? The world's greatest pianists come to perform for the president. Paderewski, Busoni, Joseph Hoffman, Sergei Rachmaninoff, Myra Hess, and that brilliant, fiery lady from San Antonio, Texas, Olga Samaroff. Her real name was, of course, Lucy Hickenlooper. Now, Steinway & Sons arranged most of the concerts held in the White House during the first half of the century, and they recommended the performing artists to the First Lady, who then made her selections. And I went through volumes of correspondence through the gracious help of the Steinway Piano Company. And Mr. John Steinway is no longer living, died about, I think, about a year ago. but he was most gracious, and I found some wonderful correspondence. What interested me was the fact that American music and American artists were really chosen for the White House, and the First Lady really wanted to bring out our own culture and to emphasize it and to promote it. There's a little story I have. This is about David Bisfahm, the great baritone from Philadelphia, time he sang for President and Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt. Bisfahm featured a group of songs by living American composers, and the last one was called Danny Deever, to the words of Rudyard Kipling. The song was so spirited that it brought the president to his feet, shouting in his typical ebullient style, "By Jove, that was bully. With such a song as that, you could lead a nation into battle." And of course, President Roosevelt had a habit of jumping up from his chair and crying bully when he heard Paderewski play too, because that was a favorite. The only thing is that he never seemed to be able to wait until Paderewski had finished playing. Another funny story about President Roosevelt. His guests did not always share his enthusiasm for music, because he invited a lot of his old trapper friends, a lot of friends from the West, and one time Captain Seth Bullock was there, and someone asked him how he liked the music, and, "Well," said Bullock, "it's most too far up the gulch for me." To which the president remarked, immensely tickled, "I was afraid Bullock might draw his guns and begin shooting the fiddlers." Now, I guess when we think of the 20th century presidents and music, of course, Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy are the first come to many people's minds. Ironically, they were enormously different in their musical interests. President Truman was an ardent music lover and an amateur pianist, but held only one series of musical programs in the White House in the 8 years he was president. John F. Kennedy, by contrast, did not really care for music at all. And I found memos, White House memos, to the effect that music hurt his ears, really. Yet the Kennedy administration of 2.5 years, or almost three, I should say, was filled with staged operas, concerts, ballet, youth concerts, and musical theater. And we know Jacqueline Kennedy was very knowledgeable in the arts, but one thing she said that I thought was fascinating, she said that she felt that her main concern was to present the best and not necessarily what was popular at the time. So beginning with the historic Pablo Casals concert, which was one of the most publicized concerts in America, the Kennedys established the White House as a prominent center for America's artistic achievements, and their dedication and creativity provided a model for succeeding administrations right to the present day. When I was looking through the music of Harry S. Truman in the Truman Library, there's a big pile of it, several piles of it, of his own music, I had to dig through the Chopin and the Tchaikovsky and the Mozart to find one single little lone copy of the Missouri Waltz, which he really didn't care for at all. But he was not shy about playing the piano, and he would play for just about anyone. He played for world leaders, Stalin and Churchill, for U.S. presidents, John F. Kennedy, for concert artists, Eugene Liszt, for movie stars, Lauren Bacall, and Jack Benny, and some others, for painters, Grandma Moses, and for some 30 million Americans during his televised tour of the newly remodeled White House. Perhaps, as he admitted, the fingers wouldn't work on all the pieces he knew, but he would play them anyway. He was once asked if he sang tenor or baritone, and he replied, "I never sing. I'm like Artemus Ward. I'm saddest when I sing, and so are those who listen to me." We all know the story about Margaret Truman, who was an opera singer, and I thought it was interesting that President Truman was really not an opera buff at all. In fact, he said one time some friends took him to a performance of Wagner's Parsifal in Kansas City. And he said he hadn't recovered from that siege of Grand Opera yet. But he did support his daughter. In fact, he supported her singing career so intensely that when the music critic Paul Hume once gave her a less than favorable review in the Post, the bristling president dashed off a vitriolic note to Hume, calling him an, quote, 8-ulcer man on 4-ulcer pay. Someday I hope to meet you, lambasted Truman. And when that happens, you'll need a new nose and some beefsteak for black eyes. We all know that that must be one of the most talked about reviews in the annals of music criticism, what Hume's piece. But most people don't realize that President Truman did this with other performances, not just his daughter. I found in the Truman Library some wonderful letters. One time, the pianist Gina Bachauer performed, and the president went to hear her at Lisner Auditorium. He didn't like the review of her, so he wrote vehemently to Philip Graham of the Washington Post. He said, "Retire this old fuddy-duddy. How does he know how Haydn should sound? Haydn is dead." You know, there's more merit in that than meets the eye or ear. There really is not enough time to tell very many of the warm and witty tales of musical activity at the White House. But I would like to say this, that I feel many of our 20th century presidents and first ladies deserve far more credit for their attention to American artistic values than we have given them. The terms of Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover, for example, brought so many outstanding musical programs to the White House that they could have rivaled Carnegie Hall. Mrs. Hoover was the first to bring an artist to the White House to perform for a head of state. And we know, of course, that this is a common practice today. One of the performers who came under the Hoover era was Vladimir Horowitz, and he was a very dazzling 27-year-old pianist at the time. He was Russian, and he spoke in a very broken English and was very concerned about his English. He didn't seem to be worried about his performance for the president, but a friend said to him, "Oh, don't worry about going through the receiving line and your English. Just say this, say, 'I am delighted,' to each one of the people." And so he did this. He passed through the line and he shook each one of the dignitaries' hands and he said, "I am delightful, I am delightful." No one seemed to mind the mishap. They probably all agreed. Now, under the administration of Franklin Roosevelt, a new era of White House history began. For during the 12 long years of this administration, more than 300 concerts were held in the White House. And I thought these programs were really very unique because they reached out to every corner of America. And they seem to reflect the Roosevelt's pride in America's variegated culture and their special understanding of the communicative powers of music in an era of depression and war. The power and pathos of black voices were a vital part of the Roosevelt White House concerts, as were unknown young artists. Important women's musical organizations knew in America. World-renowned concert and operatic artists, musicians from Pan America, China, Russia, and an array of folk singers from the sea, soil, and heart of America. Mrs. Roosevelt once said, "People can understand each other while making music in a way that would be impossible were they doing anything else in the world." What an interesting statement. I think about Leonard Bernstein, who died just a week ago, and the Berlin Wall, and how he performed Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and brought everyone together in a world celebration through music. It was wonderful. The Roosevelt's eclectic tastes, however, resulted in some very strange juxtapositions when they were planning their programs. Like the time The dancer La Argentina presented her fiery interpretation of a bullfight, followed by the Vienna Choir Boys' serene interpretation of Silent Night. Or another time, the young Metropolitan Opera baritone Lawrence Tibbett shared his program for the King and Queen of England with the Coon Creek Girls. They were a square dance team. But didn't really matter. The royal family loved it. There are other unsung presidents. President Eisenhower. I recently spoke at the Eisenhower Symposium. We did a panel on Eisenhower's cultural legacy. So little as he's been so little recognized, and he did a great deal for the arts. He brought Arthur Rubinstein to the White House for his one and only appearance there, and that great dynamic American art form, Broadway musical theater. That was the first time in the White House. Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird enjoyed an extraordinary array of ballets, performing artists, and musical shows during their administration. And the Nixons and Fords broadened their White House programs to include a wider variety of musical styles than ever before. Jazz, country, gospel, Broadway, and many other forms of American music. And you know, I just have to stop and put in a little footnote at this point about that. You know, President Nixon was criticized, and many of our presidents are frequently criticized for bringing popular music into the White House. You know, if you examine the long skein of history, you see our nation gradually opening out, accepting and cherishing its indigenous culture, and lessening its emphasis perhaps on European music always. And our presidents and first ladies were doing this. So we see this wonderful picture really giving us the gradual shaping, a vital shaping of the American national character through the arts. But the White House, with its unique melding of music, politics, and protocol, has been perennially prone to mishaps and infelicities of coordination, even though they try very hard and do a wonderful job. But I think of the time, and this story was told to me by Gretchen Poston, President Carter's social secretary. The great soprano, Clama Dale, was rehearsing below the state dining room just before her concert for President Carter and the premier of Romania. And just as the president lifted his glass and opened his mouth to begin a toast, out came, only about three octaves higher. Everybody looked around, startled. The president was very calm, and he tried again. He got up and lifted his glass, opened his mouth, and out came the scales again. So somebody ran quickly downstairs to warn Miss Dale that she was standing at the base of the shaft going up the fireplace directly behind the president. And Miss Poston said, for a moment we thought we had lost our soprano in the fireplace. Another mishap involved the United States Marine Band, which purely by accident struck up a rousing rendition of The Lady is a Tramp, just as the Queen of England started to dance with President Ford. And when John Bourgeois, leader of the Marine Band, very dignified and very fine musician, said to me, you know, we took that piece immediately out of our repertoire. Actually, it's a very lovely piece. Today, television has brought us all closer to the White House because of the many concerts broadcast from the East Room. The Carters initiated the concept, opening with the program by Vladimir Horowitz in 1978. The Reagans continued these, as you all remember. They added their own special mark by selecting brilliant young American artists as well as older world-renowned performers and by highlighting American music. President and Mrs. Bush are continuing these PBS series, and they're called In Performance at the White House. I think they give a subtitle, The House I Live In. I love that. because it speaks so warmly of Mrs. Bush and her special style and sincerity. I think President and Mrs. Bush understand very well the value of the media in opening to millions the White House as a vital force in modern American culture. And as they are committed to improving the quality of life through education, our current President and First Lady clearly value the arts as a vital facet in shaping the entire human being. The music of the White House celebrates the American spirit. It bridges nations and it binds together blacks, whites, rich, poor, just the family. It is a lyric image, a joyous vision, and probably the most graceful language of glory the president will ever know. Music will always be a vital part of the American adventure of discovery, and the White House will be a prime mover in the voyage. But while administrations change, tastes shift, and new currents explore fresh artistic terrain, in this music, the image of America remains, reinforcing our heritage and glorifying our dreams. And thank you very much. And if you have some questions, I'd be delighted to answer.
Sure, we will. Thank you very much. Who'd like to ask the first question? Yes, Mrs. Cromwell.
How much of the programs and the finance reflect the taste of the president's wife?
Well, I found that the president, the first lady, would always confer in most all the administrations with the president because he was in attendance, usually. And sometimes I would find the designation. The first lady would like the sextet from Lucia performed. The president would like Way Down Upon the Suwannee River. He would like, this was in the 19th century. So I think very often that, I think your question's a very good one, because by looking at all of this music, we really can see the personal interest. Yes, it came through very definitely. And why not? When you figure this is, the White House is so unique. There is no place like it in the world. It's a home, a personal home, and a government institution. And the home part always is paramount, I think, when you look at White House and White House history. And so the personal tastes do come through. And as I say, the Lincoln loved opera and ballads. And Jimmy Carter, of course, liked string quartets and many. Of course, what happens is that a president and first lady cannot focus too much on what they like. They have to realize all the time that they represent the nation and that the nation's arts should be brought all into focus and represented well.
Is there any way, Dr. Kirk, to connect up the president's central interests in life and politics with his music? For instance, one would have thought that given his religious interests, that Jimmy Carter would have liked hymns.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did.
Did he?
He did, yes.
And the human rights mm-hmm. aspect and so on. But can mm-hmm. can that be traced with others at all?
And Amazing Grace, of course, was one of his very closest. I think so. And of course, it all depended on what was happening in the nation. This is another thing that a study of this nature, I as a musicologist didn't really know the history of my nation like I should have. And it just brought it into focus. I was thinking, for instance, the period of the Civil War, the intense role that music played at that time. And President Lincoln did many of the songs that were important, Battle Hymn of the Republican, Battle Hymn of the Republican. That was not a Freudian slip.
That was an odd
better, right. The works of Henry Clay Work, for instance, and some of our great patriotic national songs were deeply important to President Lincoln. And many times congregations would group on the White House lawn and sing these. And I think what you're saying, what I feel is that the times that were vibrant, exciting, alive, maybe economically, maybe politically, or even tragically, is in the terms of war, that the president's taste in music came out, maybe at those times, even more in a more interesting way than when we were just in a peaceful, calm situation.
Is there a permanent staff that organizes and stages these productions at the present time?
Well, right now, and this was true, I know, for about the last maybe six administrations, the social secretary usually is responsible, and that is the first lady's social secretary, for arranging the concerts. But I'm sure she gets advice from all over, from Kennedy Center, from, do you know what I'm saying? In other words, it used to be Steinway and Sons at the turn of the century were the advisors. And in 1900, we had no social secretary in the White House. That's fairly new. Mrs. McCaffrey was telling me that when she worked under the Eisenhowers, she was the secretary for the Eisenhowers, and that the social secretary came gradually later, and that Mrs. Reagan's, now I may be wrong about this, but this is what I was told in the Hoover Library, that the whole President Hoover's staff, and this is not the political staff, but the managerial staff of the White House, consisted of the same number of people as Mrs. Reagan's social staff. And that's probably true. So what has happened is that as the arts increased, the White House had to reach out a little more and get more advice. I don't believe there's any set committee. No, not there, to answer your question. It's usually the social secretary and also the Marine Band. John Bourgeois handles a great deal of the decisions also, but that's in the ceremonial end. There are three aspects of music: ceremonial, family music making, private family music making, and concert. And the Marine Band is mainly concerned with the ceremonial, and the social secretary engages through consultation with the First Lady and her staff, the artists that come.
May I just ask a quick follow-up to that? Is there anything equivalent to the speech writers who say that the performances ought to appeal to some political interests? For instance, President Bush, as far as his speechwriters were concerned, apparently was not very happy in the beginning at the thought of "Read My Lips," but he went along in response to the urgings of the speech to essentially Peggy Noonan. But is there anything like that? Do people use music for some political purpose?
Yes, yes. I find that's very definitely true. There is a certain image-making power that music has. And I'm saying this in the noblest sense, because actually you realize that groups will come to the White House to perform from all over the nation. The President has an obligation, and First Lady, to bring, for instance, if it's an agricultural question, a group from an agricultural region to sing songs, folk songs from that region. But this is very lovely, you know? I mean, I think this is really a wonderful aspect of music, that it can say so much in so many different ways. And I think of the funny story in the on the lawn, and it was performed for members of Congress, because, and the president said, well, this is a bombastic piece of music, and it'll give you an idea of what happens with the congressional, what I put up with in congressional breakfast every other week. And in other words, President Lyndon Johnson held programs for Congress and their families. And there was always a little joking about, you know, that this was one way to open up areas through music, you know, with Congress. And many, many times there are people who come into the White House who want to give the president a piece of music. Irving Berlin came in, and we have George M. Cohen presenting music to Herbert Hoover. And many, many times this is, I could go on and on, but I won't. Yeah.
Mrs. Miller.
They are not paid. When Steinway and Sons was doing the assistance, putting on the programs, they paid the artists. And so Paderewski would have been, well, no, Paderewski was a personal friend of the Coolidges. He played three times in the White House, so they were, he would not have been paid. He did it just as a friend. Most artists are so thrilled. It's such a wonderful honor. Oh, heavens. And there's no way, I don't know. I personally, all I know is from my research that they are not paid. And it's interesting because you would wonder, you know, because they're top artists. I find what's interesting are the artists who do not sing in or perform in the White House. I've never known, Pavarotti has not yet sung in the White House. Joan Sutherland has not. There are some who, Isaac Stern has performed for 9 different presidents. And Roberta Peters has sung for something like 9 or 10. And so some genuinely are invited back because they almost become like court performers in the 17th, 18th century. They are enjoyed and give of their time and their talent. It's quite a nice association.
I have 2 questions. One is, in your research, did you find most of your information through letters or diaries, or was there a historian throughout who kept records of the entertainment? And my second question is,
to answer the first question, when I started out, and this is interesting because when my first contact was the person who's become a dear friend of mine, Margaret Clapthorne, who's in the Smithsonian, and she's head of the First Ladies Hall there, and my second contact was the associate curator of the White House, Betty Monkman. And she introduced me, I spoke not so long ago in Washington, she introduced me and she said, when Elise started to get up to do this research, I said to my boss in the White House, she's never going to find anything. That's so hard. She's never, you know, she said, they thought it was just miraculous that I was even attempting this. And she said, now she realized that there is so much that I could have filled maybe 3 or 4 more books. What I had to do was to go to primary sources. There is no book that gives any cultural history of the White House. There is no record that you can just neatly follow. You start out, as I did, with government records, with vouchers from National Archives from 1810. I had to learn all the names of, and as a musicologist, this was totally foreign to me, but I had to learn the names of the people who purchased the White House, you know, purchased for the White House and worked for the government public buildings and grounds. And these people, I were like back in 1815, 1820, 1830, who were they, you know? So if I found their names, then under their names would be all the picture hooks and like a nail had been purchased for the White House to hang one of their paintings for 2 cents, and this would be, all these records would be neatly kept. A piano had been tuned at thus and such a date, so I wanted to know what piano that was, so I had to, I wrote to all the presidential sites, you know, we have them all over the country. I was told the other day there were 300 presidential sites, and I think maybe not, would I be wrong, 100. Well, this is in addition to the 7 libraries, homes of presidents, where they lived. What? Summer homes, Monticello's one. Right. And every president, you know, has maybe 2 or 3 of these. So it would easily, I thought he said 300, maybe it may have been 100 presidential sites, all under the National Park Service. And I wrote to them for music, actual music, which some, a lot of them had, memos, diary accounts, newspaper clippings, and then I went through newspapers on my own, went through all the presidential papers, which are on microfilm in, for the early presidents, and all the papers in the social records in the presidential libraries. It just had to be pulled together through many, many, many sources. Well, I'm glad it's over. I wouldn't do it again, but it was fun when I would. Yes.
Dr. Albert, excuse me. Why don't we get the second one?
Excuse me, Dr. Albert. Did you find going through that the timing of an attaining early on was in the afternoon, or has it always been mainly evening an attainment in the White House, like in the early 1800s, was it afternoon? Would you be invited to the White House for an afternoon tea instead of after dinner?
Well, it changed with the social customs. You know, there was a period where afternoon tea was paramount, and the ladies would come with their white gloves and their hats. Mrs. Taft had a lot of these, and this was definitely a ladies' event. And the Roosevelts had Lenten musicales, which were in the daytime during Lent, and that was kind of an interesting time. But then the earlier administrations before that would have very informal. President Lincoln would just casually hear that some, it was, I remember Commodore Nutt was coming through town. He was a P.T. Barnum little singer, so high, and sang, and he heard that he was coming to town. He said, I'd like to have him come and sing in the White House. And it was very informal. But as you get into the 20th century, we find heads of state coming more and more frequently. Between the time of the first head of state, which was under Grant, and that was the King of Hawaii, to the time of the Hoovers, there were only something like 17 heads of state, and we're talking about a period of like 50 years or 60 years. And then now we have 12 a year. So those were in the evening. That started the practice of the state dinner. That's probably what you're asking. And then that, of course, the president is always in attendance, and the entertainer performs in that regard. Also, the television programs and musicales that are just separate events. President Nixon had them. He called them Evenings at the White House, and he had a series of these that were at night. So,
Dr. Alder?
You mentioned that President Grant was not exactly musically oriented. I wonder if there were other exceptions that proved the rule. You didn't mention Andrew Jackson, for example, who somehow doesn't sound very musical. Or what about Monroe?
Well, now the Monroes, what they focused on was the French culture and French tastes. And the music themselves, the Monroes were not especially musically oriented, but they appreciated European culture. I found that the first 6 presidents were very much rooted in European culture. Of course, as we know from President Jefferson, my heavens, you know. And then the Monroes brought over a piano, a very, very beautiful Erard, a perfectly gorgeous instrument that I would break my neck to be able to find. I wish I could find where it is, but I never found it. But I found vouchers describing it. and it had five pedals, which indicated that in the White House, music played by, well, it was called Janissary music. In other words, that was Turkish music that was popular in the bands at that time. So they must have played that kind of music on their beautiful Erard. So then they attended some events in Washington. But that was, and Jackson, of course, was interested in music for his children. He had a huge household full of children. And so you find puppet shows and all kinds of family musical events taking place. But then that tells you something, too, about Washington as Washington was starting to grow in the arts. More things were available. You get further on into, especially under the 40s and 50s and 60s, because then you find concert groups and operas touring. And so.
Yes,
I seem to recall that Miss Lena Horne refused to perform at the White House. Were there other artists who, for some reason or other?
Yeah. Well, now there again was a period when we were under Lyndon Johnson and there was all the opposition to the war at that time and civil rights. There was and the musical artists that came in, I always feel so sorry for the Johnsons because I think unjustly they got caught up, and there's an example of what you were saying, the politics and the music did not mingle in a felicitous, very fine way. It was, I don't know if it was Lena Horne, I think it was Eartha Kitt that came in and criticized Mrs. Johnson for being, you know, responsible for the poverty, and she was supposed to sing. She was an invited guest, which was terribly rude. And Mrs. Johnson handled it so graciously. And I just went through all of the correspondence in the Johnson Library where she would respond, and also the people who wrote in who knew about that, and a lot were black people who said, we are ashamed. We feel that the president is doing a great deal for civil rights. And another incident took place like that under the Johnsons, which was the White House Festival of the Arts. And I brought out the fact in my book, I was so annoyed at I don't want to say our press because we rely on them and we have some very fine press, but that in that time they only saw the political end of that White House Festival of the Arts, and it was very poorly covered from the musical end. From the musical end, Duke Ellington made his White House debut, and there were some wonderful musical works performed and given their premiere, Ned Roram, contemporary music. They did some wonderful things, but it was shattered by Lowell and a group of poets who came in and just unkempt. They were poorly dressed, and they had signs, and they were making people sign a petition to stop the war, and the whole thing turned into a political fiasco. It was an unfortunate time. Also under the Nixons, there was a Carol Ferracci pulled out something from her bosom of her dress, a big sign, and said, stop bombing during the performance. And but those are the only incidents that was an era. Again, see, this is what we have to see, the whole political line and the whole picture, and that was an era that we've passed through, and well, we're going through our own little era in the arts and the ups and downs with morals and yeah. Such. Yeah.
Has the White House received requests from artists to appear?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Still do?
Oh, yes. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I imagine today it must be. You know, with each of the libraries, starting with the Hoover, you find just a few. And by the time you get to, I don't know because I haven't looked into the Carters, but I know the later administrations, there are hundreds of these, all asking to perform. And it's so funny because they are filed per person. And you get the mix, famous people in one time I was looking through the people file in the FDR library, and under Stern, because I wanted to see some things about Isaac Stern, who was playing back in those days, and there was a Jacob Stern, and this was a little boy, 9 years old. Dear Mr. President, I play the violin very well, and I thought, was his name Jacob back in those days? But it's true, especially choral groups will write, and young people will write, and so it is a great honor to be selected.
Yeah. We're very pleased that Dr. Kirk's mother has been with us. You ought to have the right, if you want to ask the last question, but you could pass, too.
Yeah. Good.
Well, we've had a musical, cultural, historical feast today. Even the accompaniment from the sides of the building had diminished it. I expected somebody to suddenly come bursting through the door. It reminded me of my mother, who was a concert pianist and organist and could practice sometimes only in Sunday afternoon when the church was warm. And there was a drunk who kept coming to the door and beating on the door and saying, "I'm a student of Paderewski, let me in, let me in." But they didn't come in, so we were free. We have another feast available, and if you allow Dr. Elise Kirk and myself to leave first, why, I'll accompany her to a table where she has a few copies of her book. It's available at $20, whereas in the bookstores you pay $24. I think all the questions that haven't been answered today and all the interests that have been stimulated can be tapped much more fully, I'm sure, in the full account. But we've rarely had a presentation at the center which reflected the determined pursuit of a subject, grasp of it, and the charm and grace with which it's been presented. So we want to thank you very much.
Thank you.